KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
This is the new Microsoft Surface.
I don't think it's possible. For me, it's not possible to anticipate the reactions of people. I'm not a wizard, so I would like to be the Wizard of Oz. That's a good film, too.
As consumers and businesses begin to rely less and less on the penny, we hope that all Canadians will consider donating them to charity.
Canadian Federal Finance Minister on the phase-out of the penny in Canada. Portuguese director Miguel Gomes on his film Taboo and the fact that he wants to be the wizard. And Steve Ballmer introducing the Microsoft Surface. A little later in the show, we're going to talk about the fate of Microsoft. But first, we're joined by Vaughn Palmer, political correspondent of the Vancouver Sun, who joins us every Wednesday with news about what's happening in the great northern country of Canada, the country that's taking over. Vaughn, I talked to some people who said, Palm Springs is picking up. All the Canadians are coming up and buying property down here.
Steve, it's become a big deal up here. The buzz is that there are some terrific bargains in vacation land, as we see it, south of the border. I know a couple here in Victoria, big deal in media, who she spent about 3 months last fall scouting property in Phoenix, and they've bought a house in Scottsdale as an investment. So the American housing market is loosening up. Canadians are going back into the market. Same thing's happening in the East. Canadians in Eastern Canada, they go to St. Petersburg and they go to Florida and places like that. Here in the West, it's Palm Springs, it's Scottsdale, it's Tucson, and they're snapping up properties because there are a lot of bargains down there.
Outposts for the Queen coming in the future.
Well, and you go down there, Steve, and you program your calendar so that you don't stay out of Canada too long, because you still want to be able to collect your health benefits back here. So you get the best of both worlds, the climate of Arizona and Canadian health care.
All right, Vaughn. So right now we're hearing speculation that Sally Jewell of REI might be President Obama's Interior Department appointee. We'll see if that's the case. But there's also speculation about Governor Gregoire.
Yes. Big news in Canada is who would be the president's ambassador to Canada. Everybody liked the last one, David Jacobson, a fundraiser and associate of the president from Chicago. It's interesting, the Canadian media full of speculation about who the next ambassador to Canada might be, and the names are all women. Governor Gregoire of Washington is very high, or former Governor Gregoire of Washington, very high on the list. Here's an interesting one, Jennifer Granholm, born in Vancouver, but an American now, and Governor of Michigan. Olympia Snow, who got fed up with the Senate as a Republican from Maine, she's on the short list. Some people wondering if the new Secretary of State, he's close to the Kennedys, might pick Caroline Kennedy. And another name I thought was fascinating on the list, Susan Rice, who, as you know, got bounced from the job that John Kerry got. She might end up in Canada. So it's a big job for, as far as Canadians are concerned. It's seen as a plum appointment because there's lots of work, but it's, you know, you're not going to Benghazi. So it'd be interesting. As I said, the media up here is full of speculation. I think because of Governor Gregoire's very close relationship to Canada when she was in Washington and her role in developing the open border plan between Canada and the U.S., that it'd be a very welcome appointment up here.
Well, it's interesting. Governor Gregoire was on the list of speculation for Interior. That's going to Sally Jewell, it looks like. So
yeah.
Washington may have other people in the federal government.
We don't like to think of ourselves as a consolation prize, but there is a recognition that, you know, making the cabinet is the A list. Making ambassador even to Canada is a bit of a B list appointment.
Well, what do separatist leaders think about that? So you had Quebec separatist leader meeting Scotland separatist leader. Are those two B-list folks not getting along?
Well, the separatists are back in power in Quebec, and one of the things they do is, as they've done in the past, is try to create the conditions, as they say, for another referendum for Quebec to secede from Canada. So we've had two of these, one in 1980 and one in 1995. Separatists, as they see it, are overdue. So one of the things that Pauline Marois, the Premier of Quebec, did, she went to the big Davos Economic Summit, and she stopped over in Scotland on the way back to meet the Scottish, I guess you'd call him the separatist minister. He's the First Minister of Scotland, Alex Salmond. His party is in power in the Scottish Parliament, and Scotland's getting ready for a referendum on separation from the UK next year. Now, you know when you cover politics, right? Leaders meet. They meet behind closed doors. The big deal that tells the public that the meeting happened, that provides the TV coverage, that validates the event, is the photo op. No photo op. The Scottish leader refused to do a photo op. He refused to come out and talk to the media afterward. What Pauline Marois got was a 45-minute behind-closed-door session and a bit of an embarrassment publicly because there's no visual evidence that she ever met with the guy.
Why?
I think there's a couple of things at play here. First of all, I guess if you're a Scottish separatist, do you really want to talk to someone whose party's lost two of these things? I mean, you want to win next year in the Scottish separatist referendum. There's diplomatic realities, too. If Scotland wins a referendum to separate from the UK, they'll be looking for international recognition. Well, that will come from the Government of Canada. And the feeling is the Government of Canada quietly passed the word through diplomatic channels to the United Kingdom that Canada would be at least mildly offended if the separatist leader were given the photo op she wanted. So for whatever reason, diplomacy, Scottish self-interest, he just didn't want to be part of a media stunt, no photo op.
Oh, well. Yeah, that you don't want to upset the Prime Minister of Canada. Who is Stephen Harper in his seventh year?
He's in his seventh year, Stephen Harper, and which is amazing in a way because I think a lot of people still haven't fully adjusted to the fact that he's our Prime Minister here in Canada. But Stephen Harper has been around for, he's entering his eighth year, in fact, this month, and he doesn't face an election for a couple more years, so he'll be around for a while. They're doing these little things that they do to humanize politicians that are seen as being kind of workaholics and cold. So Stephen Harper tweeted a day in the life of the Prime Minister. So he's gone on Twitter, and he did a day in the life of the Prime Minister a little while ago, just right there at the end of January. There were a couple of awe moments in it. You know, the Prime Minister had breakfast with his cat, Stanley. He has lunch at his desk and has a fruit salad, and he's got a Beatles coffee mug. And he arrived home at the end of the day to his wife, and I love this, the family's pet chinchilla, Charlie. Everyone say, aww. Man, so Obama's got a dog, right?
Yeah.
Well, our Prime Minister has a cat. And a chinchilla. So there you go.
A chinchilla. Okay, that's an exotic pet. That's the first. I think we need more exotic pets among leaders.
Yeah, well, as someone said, in the old days, if a politician had a chinchilla, it was made into a coat. So yeah. this is an improvement.
Hey, Vaughn, you guys aren't going to have the penny anymore?
Not the penny. The Canadian Mint is phasing out the penny in Canada, the one-cent piece. They say it is more trouble than it's worth. It costs more than a penny to make a penny, and they've told the country's retailers to phase it out. Most of the big retailers reprogramming their cash registers as we speak. It will be legal tender for some time, but retailers are being ordered to round up to the nearest 5-cent piece and no longer give pennies and change. So if you've got a bunch of Canadian pennies rattling around your pocket from your last trip to Canada, you might want to spend them the next time you're up here because the penny is being phased out.
Well, we have that same issue, but we have not yet tackled phasing it out. You guys have moved first on that.
Well, I would think that, you know, there'd be penny pinchers out there that are kind of offended by this. One of the interesting things that people are going to monitor is whether retailers figure out how to program their cash registers so that prices always end up at the round-up range rather than the round-down range.
Sure.
So you could... If a good after the taxes are done comes out at $1.02, that goes down to $1. But if it comes out at $1.06, that goes up to $1.10, right? So the speculation here is that you're going to have an awful lot of prices that when the sales tax is added end up in that round up range, and very few that end up in the round down range. Randomly, if we had random pricing, it should just end up being a wash. But the feeling is some of the more clever retailers are going to figure out a way around that.
Yeah, I'm sure that'll happen.
Association of Canada will be kept busy monitoring this for some time to come, I think.
Do you have those little have a penny cups in front of registers in Canada?
Yeah. Well, I guess those will go away, or they'll be have a nickel cups now, or have a dime. Heaven help us, maybe someday it'll be have a loony.
Have a loony. I'm sure that'll happen. All right, Vaughn. It's good talking to you.
Okay, Steve. Talk to you next week.
Take care. Vaughn Palmer is political correspondent with the Vancouver Sun. He joins us every Wednesday on Weekday.
Some classic French films are showing in Seattle. We'll learn more about them from the film critic Robert Horton in just a couple minutes here. KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Soaring Heart Natural Bed Company, handcrafted mattresses and bed toppers from locally sourced suppliers for over 30 years, offering a wide selection of custom-designed pillows and comforters. Location and sleep resources online at SoaringHeart.com.
.45 degrees in Seattle and mostly cloudy. Forecast says it's going to be breezy with showers today and a high of 48. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 10:17. Tech business news and the latest on Microsoft's new tablet in 20 minutes.
But first, you know, I asked you to send some Peace Corps stories, and you did. So I would like to read you some. Since we talked with the acting director of the Peace Corps just 20 minutes ago, Wendy wrote, "I was privileged to be part of the first group of 60 volunteers in Hungary. I taught ESL in elementary school 50 miles east of Budapest. I studied in Hungary, Poland, and the former Yugoslavia as an undergrad at Lewis and Clark, which stoked my interest in learning about other cultures. I was incredibly honored to serve and loved bringing the world back home." And then she says, "Peace Corps is a terrific organization populated by a committed community of current and returned volunteers." And Jillian writes, "I joined the Peace Corps in Burkina Faso 2008-2010 because why not? A free adventure to meet new people and travel. I went to WSU, saw a recruiting table there, and so I signed up. It took 5 years until I was really ready to take the plunge. So I was glad I waited a few years after I got out of school. I helped young girls with education and empowerment. I loved my job, and I worked with family planning and girl empowerment. That job has only helped me more in my current work, empowering youth who are involved in foster care in their current lives. I never thought I would love it so much. It was hard, hot, and I got sick, but I learned a lot about myself and learned that there are many ways to communicate than just in language. Since I was awful at French and it was a French-speaking country, I even fell in love with a Burkinabe. I believe I'm saying that right, Burkinabe. Married in 2010 in country, love my mixed cultural marriage. And then Marianne, I joined because I wanted to do something worthwhile, and my job as a copy editor did not fulfill that goal. I was inspired by President Kennedy. I also wanted to see the world and learn more about it because of what Mark Twain said about travel being good for eliminating prejudice. I accomplished both goals in Uganda, serving 3 years, 67 to 1970, as a secondary teacher, weekend voluntary work camp coordinator, the best experience of my life. And also, two Peace Corps volunteers worked at KUOW, Cliff Sanderlin and Valerie Staines. And Cliff writes, "I lived in Brazil in the remote drought-stricken Northeast with a widow who had given birth to 18 children, 13 of which survived." Wow. 1968, 1971. And then he was a development director at KUOW from 81 to 88. And Valerie Staines was host of Basically Baroque. She was in the very first group, Peace Corps One, and had her photo taken with President Kennedy. Just a few stories from the Peace Corps.
And now for something completely different.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
Delicious things to eat.
The popcorn can't be beat.
The sparkling drinks are just dandy. The chocolate bars and the candy. So let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
Oh, yeah. Let's go to the lobby with film critic and longtime contributor to KUOW, Robert Horton. Also somebody who's thought about maybe the adventure of the Peace Corps awaiting.
I don't know, Steve.
No?
I'd like to.
Yeah, it sounded good. What about that mid-career rapid response?
I don't know. Do you need an advanced degree to go in the Peace Corps?
No. I don't believe so. You just need to be a committed person. Care about the world. I think that's you. You care about what's happening all around. That's why you bring in interesting films to discuss
cultural
implications. Robert Horton is also a writer at the Herald in Everett. They actually pay his wage. And he blogs at the Crop Duster and hosts the Magic Lantern, a monthly series of discussions on cinema that's at the Frye Art Museum. I do want to give credit to the Herald for that.
Me too.
Yeah.
Me too. Read me on the Herald.
Please. Read him in the Herald, because, you know, we're very lucky that you volunteer to come in here.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
I enjoy it.
Thank you very much. Now, who is Pierre Etté?
Etex.
Etex, really? I thought I was being so clever with my friend.
Etaix is the man's name.
Etaix. Never heard of him.
A goo over the E. Yes.
Never heard of him.
No, but that's okay. It's not your fault. Pierre Etex is a guy who's very much in the tradition of the great silent clowns, though he was not of the silent era. Chaplin and Keaton and Harold Lloyd and so on, but had his heyday in the 1960s in France. Huh. But for a variety of reasons, including especially legal reasons, one of those just tangled stories of lawsuits and signing away the rights to your work that goes on for decades and decades, the guy has not been well known and been unappreciated until extremely, extremely recently. So very few people outside of France have heard of him. I once had, you know, I spent some months in Paris once in the early 90s. It wasn't the Peace Corps. Going off and not making any money for a while. And a guy that I met there and got to know took me aside, and he really wanted me to watch this film that I'd never heard of. It was called Le Soupiron, and it was directed by a gentleman named Pierre Etex, and starred Pierre Etex as well. And I'd never heard of him either. But this guy that I met made it clear to me that this was something really special. This is something that we had to sit down and watch. It was in, you know, virtual religious sort of situation, because you had to watch every little detail and so on. And I watched the film, and it was really memorable because it was coming out of nowhere. I didn't know who this was, but clearly this was this very accomplished comedian, director, writer who had had his moment and then apparently gone off the world stage. He hasn't left us. He is actually alive, Pierre Etex. He's still around. But has spent a lot of time fighting these lawsuits and finally getting his movies to get shown again. And come out on DVD, which they will very, very soon.
That's just grim that those stories occur.
Amazing.
Criterion is putting it out.
I think that's
true. So it'll be nice. Nice collection.
That'll be nice, but you don't have to wait. You can go to the Northwest Film Forum because they've got a package of glorious 35mm prints of these things. And actually, they have kind of a staggered schedule for it, but it begins tonight. And for the next couple of weeks, 3 weeks or so, they're going to be showing these movies kind of one at a time.
Do you know what they're showing? And have you seen any of them yet?
I have seen a few of them. I've had a chance to look at them. Tonight is Le Grand Amour, and tomorrow night, which is Thursday night, is Yo-Yo. These are, again, films from the 1960s. Yo-Yo is one that I watched, and that was sort of a possibly some autobiographical things going on, because it's a story about someone who's grows up in the circus as a clown, and Etex himself had clown training, and it goes. It's very, very clever. In fact, it has there's a moment at which it goes from being a silent comedy to a sound comedy, and the narrator notes that the story has advanced to about 1928 or so, and therefore we can now have sound. Because that's when sound came into the movie. So since our protagonist is, you know, and now at that point we can allow dialogue into the thing. But he's a guy who creates these, you know, great sight gags and chains of jokes and executes them himself, because he's also the performer. He's got a face has that sort of severity that Buster Keaton had, the cheekbones and the lines, and frequently sort of deadpan, though not always. And he comes up with wonderful things, and you do have that kind of sense of, wow, where's this guy been?
Godard put the film Yo-Yo on his list of best films in 1965.
I believe that is true. He had an appreciation in France, for sure. It's funny because one of his films, which one is it? I think it might be As Long as You're Healthy, which shows next week, which is actually kind of a series of short films strung together, with a little bit of connective tissue, but it has this great long sequence that has to do with urban life. Some of them are rural, and he finds jokes out there, but this one is like there's a construction going on, and so the sound of the jackhammer is making everything within a couple block radius shake and vibrate. So people in their offices, everything is shaking and vibrating, everything's bouncing, and the people are bouncing, and he just kind of takes off from there and does that. But it's almost, you're saying Godard, and there's almost a sense beneath all the comedy of capturing a certain kind of madness in modern life. I was thinking of Godard's one of Godard's films, because there's a short of his called Happy Anniversary, in which the city just comes to a complete standstill as this guy tries to get home to his wife to celebrate the anniversary, and he can't do it. And it's just this crazy attempt to, you know, battle what has become of the urban mess that's around this guy.
Well, I like this review in The New Yorker by Brody about a text. His gags are reminiscent of Tati's mechanized bodily ingenuity, but where Tati was a pointillist ironist of tightly oscillating frustrations. I just like the sentence. A text is a well-mannered anarchist for whom passions themselves are corrupted and dubious. His humor is compassionate and tender, but offers no exit. Do you feel that way? Offers no exit?
I think that's fair. They're kind of self-contained bits, although there's a short, and some of his short films are playing here, and it's I think it's called Rupture, and it's a totally one of those wonderful self-contained things that everything possible within this one room that can go wrong goes wrong for this guy who's just trying to write a letter to break up with the girlfriend who has just broken up with him, apparently. So he's trying to get her back. And he can't make anything work.
Pen, desk.
Pen, paper, stamps. The stamps get fixed to the desk, and then he can't get them off again. And finally, there is only one possible exit, and I won't give away the ending, but it's extremely funny and kind of bleak in a way.
I think it's so interesting that an actor... Well, they didn't forget him in France, obviously.
Yeah, and you know, he won an Oscar. He won an Oscar for Best Live Action Short Film, because they've been giving those for a while. And so in the early 60s, I think it was for Happy Anniversary, you know, a 15-minute film or whatever it is. It was clearly, here's this clearly very ingenious creator, and he got the Oscar for that. And then he went on to make his features that were successful, a lot of which were created with the collaboration of a screenwriter, Jean-Claude Carrière, who then began to work with all of the great directors, really, in Europe. He worked with Buñuel for many of the films of the great late phase of Louis Buñuel's career. He worked with Godard. He worked with Volker Schlondorf. And he's still gone. Has written films for American productions, too.
So, Etex, as an actor, he's worked with Jacques Tati, Oshima, Robert Bresson, and Jerry Lewis.
And Jerry Lewis, yes. Lewis was an admirer of his as well.
Well, the French love Lewis, and he reciprocates.
They do. He was actually, Pierre Etex was actually in the cast of Jerry Lewis's famous unreleased film called The Day the Clown Cried, which was about a clown at Auschwitz who performed for children.
Why isn't Well, that's never been released. What's the story with that? If I may diverge.
Oh, that's a whole other show. We could go on and on. It's quite a saga.
All right.
There are legal things going on there, too.
Please to remember that so we can have that show.
We might do that because that's a fascinating early 70s incident.
Wow.
But the film was actually shot.
And edited?
Mostly, yeah. People have seen versions of it.
Wow.
Yeah.
Pierre Tex played Gustav the Great.
Okay.
Just thought I'd let you know.
I'm not one of the people who's seen it. But.
Yeah. Well, that's pretty great. I like finding out a brand new person that
really
you didn't know about and then pops into your consciousness.
Yeah. Yeah. A little nugget of film history.
What is the film? All right. So these are at Northwest Film Forum starting tonight?
Yeah, starting this week.
All right.
And going on for a couple more weeks after that.
All right. Check out Pierre Tex. How about Taboo?
Taboo is a film that, now that we speak of it, it also sort of calls back to the silent movie era in a way, but it's a brand new film. And it was much heralded on the film festival circuit for the last year, so it's finally arriving now. And is made by Portuguese director Miguel Gomez. And he is an interesting guy. He's one of those, part of that generation of filmmakers who is making movies that are not meant to involve you or have you identify with characters or any of that sort of ancient form of storytelling, but to maybe have you think about what it is you're watching and why you're watching it and what a movie is, and very interesting questions like that, which are especially interesting if they are in movies as beguiling as Taboo.
It is.
They're not always in movies.
Yeah, right. I've seen some of those other movies you've talked about.
Yes, every once in a while there's films that are much more grueling. But Taboo is a really – beguiling is the word, I guess. The first part of it, almost half of it, is set in modern-day Lisbon. We meet a woman who's – a little bit at loose ends and kind of gets dragged into the life of the elderly lady who lives next door and her servant. And at some point, the woman, the neighbor seems to be declining and perhaps fading away. And an old friend of hers is suddenly called in, who then begins to narrate what becomes the second half of the film, which purports to be, we don't know how true it is really, but purports to be the adventures that he had with this elderly lady in the 1960s in an African colony of Portugal during the last days of the colonial era. It was shot in Mozambique, but I don't think they ever actually say what it was. And so the second half of the movie is kind of very lush and has romantic qualities to it, maybe romantic with quotes around it. It talks about an illicit love affair, and it's almost like Out of Africa, but without the pretty photography and the, you know, unquestioned kind of romance and so on. It's sort of looking at that from inside out and examining what that might be. And the odd thing is, and I didn't even think about this until that section of the movie was maybe 20 minutes old, but there's no dialogue. It's actually kind of a silent film.
Really?
We hear the narration of this fellow as he's recalling this past life event, but except for some songs that are sung on screen by people who want to be rock and roll stars, it's the early 60s.
Yeah, sure. They knew the Beatles.
They would have known the Beatles, otherwise there's no dialogue. So you're in this kind of strange world. It's black and white too, so it has all these layers of oddness about it.
You wrote to us, very interesting film, looking at the way we turn our memories into movies. That's possibly what it's about anyway.
I would take a stab that that's one of the things that it's about. Yeah, is that we don't know whether this narrated thing that's being told to us is real or what, but it looks like someone's memory of something, and it's probably a little bit better than what really happened. It's it's a memory that's been turned into a movie by one's memory.
Have you seen other films by Miguel Gomez?
I saw his previous film, which I think was also shown at the Northwest Film Forum, but he's only had two features thus far, so he's still coming on, but this film has been his breakthrough. He's been very critically lauded for this one, and I think deservedly so. It's a movie that has a real sense of mystery about it.
Nice.
Yeah.
And as you wrote, continue globetrotting. You're teaching a class at the UW's Osher program, an adult education program. What does Osher stand for? Do you know?
I'm sure it stands for something.
All right.
And
we'll look that up.
I should know that.
You should. I'll enlighten you by the end of this conversation.
Thank you.
But your four sessions on the great age of German cinema.
That's right.
I did not know that was your interest.
I've lectured about that before, and this is going to be four lectures in a class that you can sign up for, in March. And the idea is to go on German cinema from the beginnings of cinema, so the late 1890s, until about 1938, which was the release year of Leni Riefenstahl's Olympia, her film about the Berlin Olympic Games, and everything in between there. And that was one of the great eras of the cinema in Germany during that time, the silent era. Fritz Lang, F.W. Murnau's Last Laugh, Marlene Dietrich's first movie, The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, Expressionism as an artistic form. It's just chock full of incredible, incredible things. And then you have the collapse of that as well. As Hitler comes into power in the early 30s, the exodus of talent from Germany to Hollywood, and some of the interesting things that went on then, including Leni Riefenstahl and her totally fascinating career.
What was that transition moment? I know it wasn't a moment, but that transition from those folks to Leni Riefenstahl. What were there films being made then? I mean, were people still making films?
All the time, yeah.
And did they that were in Germany about what was happening? I mean, did they tell the story of what was happening as it was happening to them? Were they afraid because they...
Oh, at a certain point, there was nothing like that would have been released. No.
They were heading out.
Yeah.
They were making contacts.
And by the time, Hitler was in power, 32, 33, a movie like that would not get released.
If it were
questioning.
Yeah, yeah.
Fritz Lang got a little bit of trouble for making a film that... maybe alluded to some Nazi quotations by putting them into the dialogue of the criminals in his film. It was time for him to leave, like it was for most of the free-thinking artists at that time.
Were those filmmakers from the 1890s to the 1930s before Leni Riefenstahl, were they pioneers in filmmaking?
Definitely. A lot of them were making up that language that we now know.
So when Murnau and Lang and all those other guys came here, they brought with them, did they energize Hollywood?
They energized it, and they even helped define it. When Ernst Lubitsch came in the 1920s, he came before that exodus. But he helped, create the narrative form practically of what became like the Hollywood romantic comedy, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
Lang and Murnau were both visionaries, and when they came over, people were imitating them all over the place in Hollywood. What we know as film noir, for instance, is completely inflected by the German traditions of photography and design that were really, really developed on film in the 1920s. It's an incredibly rich period. You have to be over 50 to take the class.
Yes, the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute at the University of Washington invites adults over 50 to come together to share intellectual interests and make new friends.
Yeah, so I'm sorry.
You're going to make some new friends.
I'm sorry to those of you under 50, but you are out of luck.
Are you under 50?
No, I'm not.
Yeah.
No, I can teach the class.
Because you're over 50.
I don't know.
And I could come.
Yes, I hope I could certainly come.
That's what you were going to say.
But you could certainly come. I haven't worked for this program before, but I'm intrigued by it, and it's going to be on. It's going to be in March. So
you'll show some clips.
Definitely.
Did you watch the Super Bowl?
I watched some of the Super Bowl.
Did you watch the Beyoncé?
I saw only a few moments of.
Oh, I was going to ask you if it was a spectacle worthy of modern world.
I really tuned in after the blackout.
Oh,
so I missed a lot of that.
Well, that was a spectacle worthy of the modern world.
That was kind of interesting.
Just a reminder that we're always at war with some aspect of the room we get trapped in.
Of the room we get trapped in, no kidding. Yeah, the stamps get stuck to the desk. It is interesting. It's a little interesting just to see what happens when we get so used to things being slick and time to the second, as the Super Bowl is. There's almost no life to it at all anymore. And then when something like that happens, you do get a little glint of actual humanity sometimes.
Yeah. I think the people on the East Coast, especially in New Jersey, they know that perfectly well right now, especially the people who still don't have power.
Yes.
All right. Robert. Thank you.
Can I invite you to a couple things, Steve?
I would love you to.
If you're at the Sammamish Library tonight,
I might be.
Come see me.
Where is the Sammamish Library?
It's in Sammamish.
Up there on the plateau.
I don't know about plateaus, but it's near Issaquah. It's in the town of Sammamish, and I'll be speaking on the Humanities Washington Speakers Bureau talk that I give, which is on the westerns of the 60s and 70s.
If you could wrap in some German filmmakers, I think that'd be very interesting.
We're going to leave them out. And on Sunday at the Frey Art Museum at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I'll actually be talking about a different great age of cinema, which is the Soviet cinema of the 1920s, in a talk at the Magic Lantern series.
Eisenstein and his pals?
Yeah, exactly. That, which was a very revolutionary in more ways than one, you might say. But a totally fascinating.
Some of those guys come to the States?
Well, Eisenstein came,
yeah,
and he tried to get a movie made. You know, it was like he was going to make a movie for Paramount, and then he went to Mexico and shot all
That's
kinds
right.
of footage that never got made. And then he got yanked back, and he got brought to heel.
Yeah.
Taught a few lessons.
Yeah.
Re-educated, you might say.
Yeah. Well, Stalin, he knew how to do that.
Dab hand at that sort of thing.
He probably wanted to make movies himself.
Well, he was certainly aware of the power.
Yeah.
That's for sure.
Yeah. Well, that'll be interesting. You're doing some interesting things.
Hope you can join me.
All right. And people can go to the Crop Duster to find out more info about that.
If you want to look up on that stuff and find the links, yes.
Yeah, good.
My website.
Yeah. And we have a link at kuow.org. Robert Horton.
Thank you, Steve.
Talk to you again.
Ten 41, the latest news from the world of tech in a minute.
Hi, this is Melissa Block. In order to keep KUOW and NPR operating properly, we count on support from listeners. Every minute of public radio service every day is made possible by listeners like you. You may have recently received a renewal reminder in the mail. Please mail it back or renew online at kuow.org. And thanks from all of us.
As U.S. forces head home, Afghanistan wants its own tanks, planes, and other conventional weapons. Washington says that wish list won't help fight insurgents.
If we're going to be paying the bills, I think it's reasonable to ask that the military we're building pursue interests the United States has in the region.
Today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That's later today on KUOW's Afternoon News Magazine, today from 3 to 8 p.m.
Support for KUOW comes from Cupcake Royale, now featuring Death Cake Royale until Valentine's Day. Stumptown Espresso Ganache atop Theo Chocolate Decadence with Fleur de Sel. Also offering cupcakes like Red Velvet, Salted Caramel, and more. Pre-order and delivery info at cupcakeroyale.com.
45 degrees in Seattle, heading towards a high today of 48. It's cloudy now, and the forecast says it's going to be breezy today with showers. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 10:42. The brother of Italy's former Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi is under fire for making a racist remark. The full story in the news at 11.
Oh, those Berlusconis. They're fun people. I know Jon Stewart was very upset when Berlusconi sat down because he wasn't going to be able to make jokes about him, but I'm sure he will again. All right, Todd Bishop is here, co-founder and national editor of GeekWire, independent technology news site based in Seattle. Good to see you, sir.
Good to see you too, Steve.
I have a confession to make first.
I've been looking forward to this.
Last time you were here, I made a comment about the Kindle Fire, which I used some points to get the Kindle Fire because I was curious, and and I did. But I was saying I was having trouble with it. It wasn't grabbing me, and you told me, start using your mail on it. Plug in the mail app, and then see what happens. And I did that.
This is not a confession. This is progress.
Well, yes, it's a useful tool.
Okay.
And its size was very useful. And so if I said anything negative about the Kindle Fire, I didn't get an email from Amazon or anything.
Yes, I'm sure you got it from Jeff at Amazon.
Yeah, that's right. I just thought, you know, since I was speaking without any knowledge, which I often do, I thought in this case where I gained some knowledge, I thought I would say that it was you, and you were exactly right. Using it for mail prompts you to sort of explore the technology, and it has many interesting features.
I'm glad I could set you straight.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And now you have a fancy new machine here in front of me.
Right. Sitting here on the table, just imagine, if you will, this is the Surface Pro the new tablet from Microsoft that's coming out on Saturday. The big difference here between what they released in October is that it runs legacy Windows applications. This is based on a good old-fashioned, although brand new, Intel processor, the Core i5. And it's a little bit thicker, but this is an actual Windows PC versus the Surface RT, which only runs the new style Windows applications, the Metro applications.
For metrosexuals? I mean, the Metro applications.
Yeah, this is maybe why they shifted away from that name. They actually shifted away from that name, but I continue to use it. They're actually calling them modern UI applications.
Oh, well, that helps.
Yes, it's even worse, I know.
User interface, right? Yes. Modern user interface. Yes. All right, so what makes this better, yep. Worse, different?
So the big thing here is this is essentially a three-in-one machine, and it's really the embodiment of Microsoft's Windows 8 strategy. You can use it as a tablet. You can use it as sort of a pseudo notebook on the road with the keyboard cover, the type cover.
Would you like to make that noise at this point since we see it in the commercials?
Okay, so here you go. Here's the snap in.
Very nice.
So yeah, it's loud,
yeah,
at least.
That's what we want.
And then if you plug this into your regular old external monitor on your desk, it actually can operate as a good old-fashioned PC if you don't mind some relatively limited storage on it. So this is the idea of not making you buy a MacBook and an iPad. That's what Microsoft's going after here.
Oh, I see. I see. Because this, I can plug the machine directly into my monitor, and then I have a PC.
A Windows PC.
So storage is an issue, but how about speed?
Speed is perfectly fine. It's a Core i5 processor from Intel, which is, you know, a good modern chip. And it's just something that you could use as a desktop computer if you wanted to. There are some quirks that I'm happy to get into as well.
Well, first of all, how have you been using it?
I've been using it primarily as a notebook. You know, the type cover is not great. I wouldn't want to use it as my sole machine. But I've been using it with more of a on my desktop. I've been using it with a regular old USB keyboard, and it works fine. It can be a decent notebook. The big downside is battery life. You're talking about 4 to 5 hours, roughly, doing normal tasks.
A
little less than four if you're doing really intensive video. And that's where it starts to fall apart just a little bit, and it's going to be a tough sell for some folks. In addition to the price, it's starting at $899.
Oh, yeah, really?
Without the keyboard cover. If you get the keyboard cover, it bumps it up to more than $1,000. And that is why Microsoft is positioning this as an alternative to the MacBook Air plus iPad versus an alternative to the iPad. This is not really a alternative to just purely having a tablet. This is positioned as a computer.
I see. So you're getting both.
That's the idea. That's their pitch.
And at that price, it's a comparable cost.
It is. Yeah.
To an iPad.
So an iPad, you're talking $500-$600. This, you're talking $900 to start. So it's really more comparable to like an Ultrabook class notebook out there. Although you can get those for as low as $750 if you want. It's going to be tough. I don't know that there's a huge market for this particular.
Do you have a MacBook Air?
I have a MacBook Pro.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah. So, I mean, the MacBook Air is a lightweight laptop.
It is, but no touchscreen. So
right. That's
where Microsoft is.
Do you use the touchscreen on this?
I end up using it, yeah, a lot, in part because the keyboard and the pad on the keyboard is not fantastic. So you end up making up for that by using the touchscreen.
Any other quirks, as you mentioned?
Yeah. So when you try to use this with dual screens, in other words, the Surface running on your desktop and then also powering the external monitor, It does this weird thing where I'd love to just use this as my dashboard down below where the Surface sticks to the screen. But when you click on the traditional desktop on your external monitor, it flips the Surface screen to the traditional desktop too. And I've been through it with Microsoft. I've tried to get the settings fixed, and I'm doing it right. It's just that it's one of these weird things where it almost makes it unusable in some ways.
Yeah, because that would be great if this was like your remote control
exactly. To
your desktop.
Not only that, but you could sit down on your Surface and have, you know, the ESPN app or radio or, you know, weather, and you could use this as sort of your window into the world and then have your applications running on your big monitor. But they've it's a Windows 8 quirk. It's not just the Surface. It's an issue with Windows 8 in general, and it's something they need to fix.
Windows 8.
Yes.
How's it?
Not feeling it?
Well, I don't use it. We don't use it here yet, but we use the, I don't know, we upgraded to something. I don't know what.
Probably 7, I would imagine. Yeah.
I don't think we're still running XP, but I can't remember. But Windows 8's got a lot of bad rap around it, huh?
You know, it's been mixed. Microsoft has sold more than 60 million licenses,
wow,
which is not a small number. That said, the PC market was down 5% in the fourth quarter, despite the release of Windows 8. So it did not lift the market. And Microsoft is going to need to work hard with its PC partners to make sure that new computers coming out are actually more appealing.
Hmm. Well, all right. So 2 points on that. So are they going to make a dent in the tablet market with this Surface Pro?
No. This is, and really, I don't even think this will be counted in the tablet numbers. I think this will be considered a PC, the Surface Pro in particular. The Surface RT, the original version that came out in October that does not run old Windows applications, it's more of an iPad competitor, that one did not crack into the top five. The estimates were somewhere around only 900,000 units sold, which, you know, compares to millions upon millions of iPads. So this is still very, as Microsoft would say, it's very early days.
Who's cracking? Samsung?
Yeah, you know, Android tablets are doing well. Uh-huh. And part of that is the Kindle Fire, frankly. They're doing well. And we've talked about this in the past. The risk for Amazon is making sure they're not the fruitcake of tablets that just get gifted as a holiday gift and don't really have much traction the rest of the year. Amazon needs to make sure it's a little bit more than that.
Well, there you are. That's why you told me to set up the mail.
Set up the mail, right.
Very interesting, the fruitcake of tablets.
Yeah.
All right, and the other thing that Microsoft is doing, and which is fascinating to me, they're loaning Dell $2 billion so Dell can go private. We talked about this before, but what does Microsoft gain from that?
Primarily, Microsoft is propping up a big and strategic partner here with Dell. You know, if Dell went away, you know, it's still one of the largest PC makers in the world, one of the largest vendors of Windows PCs. You know, if they were not around anymore, it would be a big blow to the Windows business. And, you know, even as Microsoft makes its own hardware, you still need those PC vendors out there, Dell, HP, Acer, Asus, all of them, to be making good Windows machines. And that's frankly the struggle that Microsoft has as it starts to make hardware, is it's, you know, ticking those people off at the same time because it's competing with them. And so, you know, it's kind of a balance. But this loan to the people who are taking Dell private is all about making sure that there's a viable PC market still out there.
All right. So give me your prognosis.
On Dell?
Yeah.
It's going to be a tough one for them. I mean, they have struggled to really crack the consumer market in recent years. You know, they're still chugging along, but it's a tough one, and you know, the thing is, the iPad is really biting into that low end of the Windows PC market. If you have $500, $600 to spend, 3 years ago you probably would have purchased a netbook or a relatively low powered Windows PC. Now you're probably getting an iPad, and that is this sort of cannibalization, as they call it, that's really upending a good portion of the traditional PC business.
Or a Samsung or an Android or something.
Yep.
I heard this morning on Marketplace Tech Report, Will.i.am, talking about, where's the smart wall? I mean,
right.
Why do I hang a TV on my wall? Where's the smart wall? Where's the smart table? He's right, isn't he? And isn't that sort of where we're going to see it go?
Absolutely. And the whole idea is to have sensors all around you, and, you know, all these processors that can take all the data from the sensors and use projectors to put things on your wall. And if anybody out there ever has a chance to go to the Microsoft Home, the home of the future in Redmond, you can actually see this stuff. They've got it there. The problem that Microsoft has is taking those kinds of concepts from their labs to actual commercialization. You know, they had some success with the Kinect sensor, but, you know, other than that, a lot of the things that they've done have gotten stuck in that research area, and that's one of their challenges.
Todd Bishop is here. He's co-founder of GeekWire. He cranks out stories about what's happening in the most positive way. I say crank out.
And my colleagues.
Yeah, and John Cook and the others. Yeah, you get about what's happening in the tech world around the country. They're based here. Amazon has a virtual currency now?
That's right. Amazon joined the likes of Facebook and Microsoft. Just yesterday, they announced plans for their own virtual currency that people will be able to use on the Kindle Fire. And they'll be able to buy apps and games. The benefits of this to the end user aren't super clear. You know, in some cases, virtual currencies have tax benefits if they're international for end users. Yeah, and for developers, you know, because you're basically not doing a conversion necessarily as you go across if you're selling items, for example, on Xbox Live.
I get that. I see. Because on Xbox Live, you have to buy credits in order to, or whatever we call them.
You do. The nice thing about what Amazon is doing is it's one-to-one. So if you have 299 credits, that's the equivalent of $2.99 US. Whereas on Xbox Live, it's like you need a math degree sometimes to figure out how much money you actually have. And now that is the benefit of Amazon launching this only in the US to start. It'll be interesting to see if they can maintain that kind of, you know, one-to-one setup when they actually expand internationally.
What are they? So it's for Kindle Fire stuff. It's for apps and games and things.
So if you have an Amazon credit, you'll be able to essentially pay for things with those credits in the Kindle Fire, like apps and games.
I see. They think it'll just be quicker, more efficient for people. Because, I mean, they have our credit card information anyways.
They do, but the more credits you have, the more you're locked into Amazon's business, and that's really where they're headed.
I see. That makes sense. It's like going to the car wash and having to buy the car wash tokens.
Right. Yeah, or I was going to say the arcade. When you've got all the tickets, you can
use
the arcade to redeem
them. That's good. They're still using the old thinking.
Yes.
You also, I just want to ask you about, you didn't write this story, but your colleague did, Rover.com?
That's right. This is a dog sitting service that actually has a fantastic story behind it. A local venture capitalist by the name of Greg Gottesman pitched this at a startup weekend event as a new company. They started to develop the company over the weekend. They basically built it, and it's now a real company many months later. And basically, it's matching people with extra space to put your dogs up for the weekend or for the week with people who need to put their dogs up for the week.
Wow, couch surfing for your pets.
Exactly. And
that's
just
brilliant.
A ton of money, and they're really charging ahead. It's kind of like the Airbnb for dogs.
Yeah, there you go, Airbnb. So it's 4,300 cities, and so people can make a little money and people can know their animal, and people get vetted in the same way. And
right, and it's part of this trend of taking excess capacity in the real world and using online marketplaces to create value from that. And that's really where it's fascinating. You see that playing out in all sorts of areas. And this is just one example.
That's a smart one.
Yeah.
I like that one. And Airbnb and those are another, and more to come, huh?
Absolutely. This is key. I mean, if there's one thing that the internet can do to really help push the economy forward, it's finding these inefficiencies and creating these connections to take advantage of those and create new value
for everybody. I mean, that's how come it's valuable.
Because
I get value as a dog owner or a dog offerer.
Exactly. So it's neat when you can see things actually, you know, benefiting people like this.
And then the middle person just takes a little slice of each transaction.
Exactly.
Just how markets have worked.
That's right.
Very interesting. You play ping pong?
I'm a big ping pong player, although, and I know what you're alluding to, we have a big tournament coming up on March 6th at the Showbox. It gets a bunch of tech folks and anybody else out to compete, and we had more than 100 people compete last year.
And ping pong because?
It's essentially the official sport of the tech industry in a lot of ways. It's very rare to find a tech company that doesn't have some sort of ping pong or foosball table set up, which we also have a foosball tournament. So this is an annual event that we've done, and we had hundreds of people out last year, and we're having folks out March 6th at the Showbox Soto. So if you just go to GeekWire, you can register even as an attendee, a spectator, or just a competitor.
And it's your anniversary too.
It is. It's our second anniversary as GeekWire, and this will be a big bash. It's sort of a nice way to shake off the winter blahs and have some fun playing ping pong and socializing and eating and drinking.
Very fun. You can challenge Todd Bishop.
Absolutely.
When you're there.
And you'll kick my butt, no doubt.
Todd Bishop is co-founder, national editor of GeekWire. It's based here in Seattle. He is also on the radio with his partner on, you're still on the radio, are you?
Oh, absolutely.
On Cairo Radio on Saturdays.
On Saturday mornings, yeah.
All right. So there you are. You're everywhere. You're multiple platforms.
That's right.
You're looking for those areas in between.
Yes, inefficiencies, yes.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks, Steve.
Bernard Ouellette's our engineer. Weekdays produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Magano, Andy Hurst, Amin Al-Sadi, Daniel Anthony Goodwin, our intern. I will talk to you again tomorrow. Thank you for listening. Have a good day.
10:59, Defense Secretary Leon Panetta says that defense budget cuts will damage the economy and degrade the military. More on that in the news in a minute. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW-Tumwater, KQOW-Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from Cirque du Soleil, presenting Ama Luna, an emotional story of love put to the test between a goddess queen's daughter and a brave young suitor. Performing now through March 24th at King County's Marymore Park. Details and tickets available online at CirqueDuSoleil.com.
As you know, immigration issues have been in the news a lot lately. Let's personalize the issue. Tell us your immigration story. Did you wait for years to come to the U.S.? Did you come on a student visa or an H-1B visa? Did you come to the U.S. without documentation? Tell us your story today at noon, or you can give us a call right now, 206-221-3663. 206. Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.